Today, we are going to continue our study of the Sabbath that we began in late July and August. In those two sermons, we examined how the Sabbath was made by God for all mankind, and we looked at various scriptures that tell us of the plan and purpose that God had in creating the Sabbath. And as you think about the scriptures, when you go through the scriptures, you can't find one scripture that indicates that God at any time annulled or did away with the Sabbath. You can't find it. You won't find it even in Paul's writings. Paul sometimes writes some complicated things and discusses some complicated subjects in regard to the law, but you cannot find one scripture that Paul wrote that supports the Sabbath. Whether you should keep it or not was not a controversy. The issue was how to keep it. And in the New Testament, the controversy was still how to keep it. And to a degree, that's an issue today. Remember that the first four commandments deal with our relationship with God. And they describe in four different ways the ways that we can commit adultery by not following those following those first four commandments. And idolatry is a major sin of mankind, and our world is filled with idolatry. Remember that the first commandment deals with what we worship, and we are to worship our Creator. The second commandment deals with how we worship, and that worship is to be in spirit and in truth. So we don't use statues, we don't use pictures, we don't use art or anything like that to portray God or to be a part of our worship of God. So that's just something that we as Christians are to avoid. The third commandment has to do with the quality of our personal witness of everything that the name of God implies. We bear God's name, and as we go forward and in the way we live, we represent God. We are followers of Christ, and so they're looking at us and questioning, are you a Christian? Are you a follower of Christ? And by the way that we conduct our lives, then we can bear witness to that spiritual name that has been placed upon us as God has given us His Spirit. And the fourth commandment was given to better enable us to worship the one true God by providing us with the time to worship Him, by providing us the opportunity to fellowship with Him and to better understand Him and ourselves, and how we fit into that relationship. We see our purpose and God's plan more fully as we keep the Sabbath. So how to use the Sabbath time then becomes an issue of paramount importance for all of us. And we are God's people, so how do we keep the Sabbath? And I think this is a most important sermon of the ones that I'm going to give in regard to the Sabbath. Because as you look at people and the Sabbath, they feel that Christ dealt a blow to keeping the Sabbath. So the way that he interacted with the Sabbath as he came in the flesh, they felt that what he did basically undermined the Sabbath by being involved in various provocative acts. The feeling is that the apostle supposedly continued on with this teaching, undermining the Sabbath, but as you really understand what is taught in the Bible, you see that didn't happen at all. So this sermon, after a bit of groundwork at the beginning, is going to concern itself with Christ's attitude toward the Sabbath. Did Christ uphold the Sabbath? And as he carried out various acts on the Sabbath day, why did he carry those acts out, and what can we learn from them? So we're going to see that far from annulling the Sabbath, he magnified it. And in doing that, he gives us the foundation for judging the value of our own Sabbath activity. How did he act, and how do we act? Let's begin in Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20, and begin in verse 10. Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 10. It says, "Therefore I made them go out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness, And I gave them my statutes and showed them my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. So we're to live by the things that God has revealed in his word. And God showed them various things that they were to live by. He says in verse 12, moreover, I also gave them my Sabbaths. Notice it's plural. He's not just talking about the weekly Sabbath, but he's talking about the annual Sabbaths as well. God gave them the weekly Sabbath and the annual Sabbaths. All of them were given to them to guide them in how they would worship and honor God. So I gave them my Sabbaths to be a sign between them and me, and that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. So when you begin to keep the Sabbath, you automatically are different. You're not trying to be different from other people, but the vast majority of the people in the world do not keep the Sabbath. So when you begin to keep the Sabbath and the holy days, you immediately are different. And it signifies that you have entered into a relationship with the great God. Let's go down to verse 18. So God gave them his Sabbaths. And then let's pick it up in verse 18. But I said to their children in the wilderness, do not walk in the statutes of your fathers, nor observe their judgments, nor defile yourselves with their idols. So he said, don't be involved in those things, those sinful actions of idolatry, those sinful worship practices that they had picked up in Egypt. In verse 19, it says, I am the Lord your God, walk in my statutes, keep my judgments and do them. And what does God expect of them? It says in verse 20, hallow my Sabbaths. Keep them holy. Observe them as periods of holy time. And they will be a sign between me and you that you may know that I am the Lord your God. So if you want to know God, you want to have a relationship with God, then it's imperative that we keep the Sabbath day. So we are to keep the Sabbath holy. They are a sign between us and God. And it is something that's important to God, how we observe them. And God notes how we observe them. It's an indication of what is important in our life. So keeping the Sabbath identifies the true God to us. And I think that we will see as we go along that it is not merely the fact that one observes the Sabbath day, but rather it is observing the day combined with how we observe it. So it's not a matter of just being present on the Sabbath. It's a matter of how we observe it. So what did we do at home before we got here? What do we do after services today? That's all part of it. It's not just the 2 hours that we happen to meet here at services. It's much bigger than that. People can surely set aside, as the Jews did, and not keep it right. They believed in the Sabbath, but they didn't observe it properly. As you think about that, and they were strict Sabbath keepers from one point of view, but did they know God? Did they know God? By the very fact that they did not recognize God in the flesh and rejected him tells you they didn't know God. They thought they knew God and took a lot of pride in that, but they didn't know him. It's obvious that they didn't know him, and even though they were, you know, if we were looking at them, we would say they were keeping the Sabbath. So it's obvious they didn't know him, and so the instruction here is that it is not merely a matter of just observing the day, just taking the time out. You can take from sunset to sunset and set it aside and not keep the Sabbath. But you in your mind can think, I'm keeping the Sabbath. But it goes beyond that. It's how the day is observed that enables one to know God. Back to Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 21. It says, notwithstanding, the children rebelled against me. They did not walk in my statutes and were not careful to observe my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. They heard the instruction, but they didn't follow the instruction. They weren't doers of the word. But they profaned my Sabbaths. Then I said I would pour out my fury on them and fulfill my anger against them in the wilderness. Verse 22, nevertheless, I withdrew my hand and acted for my name's sake that it should not be profaned in the sight of the Gentiles in whose sight I had brought them out. So they did not keep the Sabbath, and God made note of that. And we find what action God took in verse 24. It says, "Because they had not executed my judgments, but had despised my statutes, profaned my Sabbaths, and their eyes were fixed on their father's idols." So they were involved in idolatry. They despised God's statutes. And they were punished accordingly. And they did not execute God's judgments. They despised his statutes and his Sabbaths. And their eyes were fixed on their father's idols. And that's kind of a concluding statement of what Ezekiel has to say. So I think there are two possibilities regarding Israel's Sabbath breaking. One, Israel completely rejected the Sabbath. And another is, they didn't observe it properly. So it could have been a combination of the two. It could have been one or the other. In all probability, there were people that didn't keep the Sabbath, and there were also people that didn't keep it properly. So all of this led to their being taken into captivity. And that is the outcome, as we do not keep the Sabbath properly. We lose our perspective and we go into captivity. So how do we keep the Sabbath? When one looks at secular history and even biblical history and in the society around us, how to keep this day is a mixed bag. There are various points of view, and people are all over the place on the particular subject. In today's world, we're pretty much confronted with the situation where few people know how to keep the Sabbath. They haven't grown up keeping the Sabbath. That's not the world we live in. The world does not keep the Sabbath. As you look at fairly recent history, society has undergone a radical transformation and moved away from the Bible. People aren't familiar with the Bible. They don't know who Moses was. They don't know who Jonah was. They don't know anything about the whale. They don't know anything about coming through the Red Sea. They don't know about Abraham or any of it. They don't know about Jesus. Or they may have heard about it, but they don't know a great deal about it. And our world is moving further and further away from a biblically based life. Many of us grew up and we heard the stories. We may not have understood the whole picture, but we heard these things growing up. We may have grown up and attended church, and we knew some of those things, which unfortunately people are moving further and further away from. And you know, if you grew up, as I did, I kept Sunday. Many of you kept Sunday. Some of you didn't keep anything at all. Some of you grew up in the church, so you've known about the church throughout your whole life. But if you grew up in my background, you grew up on Sunday, and you kept Sunday. And what was Sunday like? Well, for most of in my time, you went to church at a certain time, maybe 10, maybe 10:30. You were there for an hour. Church was over, and we could do what we wanted. We could play football. We could watch football. We could play baseball, basketball, hang out with our friends, do all these things, because that was it. We had fulfilled our religious obligation. And that's the direction that the world has taken, and so you just have an hour basically devoted to God during the week, and then you're free to do what you want. But as you look at the world has an approach to work and all of that has developed as a result of industry. Industry's goal is to use every minute of the day for production purposes. So most businesses, that's how they operate. So if we can keep our store open for 24 hours, or we can run production for 24 hours, we'll do it. So we'll schedule three shifts or whatever is needed in order to get the production out and make the maximum amount of money. And that's the world that we live in. You go back in the 1950s and you had a lot of industrial plants and people were scheduled to work one shift out of their three shifts during the day, they would work one of them. And a lot of companies, what they did is they changed the shifts. So maybe you would work the day shift, and the next week you were working second shift, and you may eventually cycle into third shift. And you never got into a regular pattern. And I could not imagine working third shift all the time. And some people liked it, but I just couldn't see me doing it based upon my sleep patterns. But that's how it was. And the goal is for everybody to work and to put in all the time at work possible in order to make production. And virtually every business in the United States and indeed all around the world does that. That's the businessman's approach. That's the businessman's approach. And as you think about that, it's as if a man is saying, you know what? I am the measure of all things, and I'm not answerable to anyone, and everything totally belongs to me and how I want to run it. In turn, people are very aware of free time, so they're having to work a lot, so when there's the opportunity to have free time, they're very conscious of it. So what am I going to do with my free time? Am I going to go to church? I'm working, and I need a break from all that. And so church is just another added responsibility. And we find that people's lives are so booked up that they don't have time for anything else. And the goal is to get the most out of life. That's how it is. And so people are going a mile a minute. I've got to go to work, then I'm going to go have a workout, then I'm going to go out to dinner, then I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do the other thing. A lot of people with children, their children are involved in baseball and swimming and all sorts of activities, and you're transporting them from here to there, and that's pretty commonplace. And parents are very busy with their children, and but that's just the world that we live in. As you look at Sunday, it became, as I said, the religious hour of worship. And this is not always the way it has been. I know, talking to my grandmother, Sunday used to be like the Sabbath. It was a day that was set aside and you didn't work. You went to church and you stayed at home. And businesses were closed. There were no restaurants open. There were no stores open. And you couldn't buy any booze on Sunday. So you had to get that done on Saturday, the other 6 days of the week. But people more or less stayed home, and various church groups, they did have church all day. It was an all-day affair, because I've talked to kids that went, and it was an ordeal. It never ended. It just went on and on. And for some people, that was the way it was. Thankfully, we did the hour of prayer, so we did not do that all day. Because knowing how we were, we would have been a little agitated by the end of the day. So, and as you look at this hour of worship, this is not something that's just a trend in the world apart from the Church of God. It's a trend in the Church of God, where people come to church for the 2 hours, and I can do what I want before, and I can do what I want after. So that's not everyone in the church, but it is the trend. You're becoming like the world. And even though we believe in the Sabbath, again, it's not whether you believe in it or you show up for 2 hours, but it's how you keep it. Are we keeping the Sabbath? When we look in the Bible, we find that God does not give us many specifics on how to keep the Sabbath day. I don't know whether you've ever thought about that, but he doesn't give us lots of specifics. So if the light's going off in your head is telling you there aren't many specifics, so we can do what we want, that's not what I'm saying. So I'm not trying to liberalize the Sabbath by what I'm saying. I'm just saying if you go through and look at all of the verses in the Scriptures, God does not give us a lot of specifics. He does give us broad principles, and our goal is to understand the broad principles and live by them. Ask yourself this question. Where do you find the most instruction in the Bible regarding keeping the Sabbath? Where do you find the most instruction in the Bible regarding keeping the Sabbath? Is it in the Old Testament, or is it in the New? So you're probably thinking, I think it's the Old Testament. I mean, that's where the commandments are. That's where Isaiah 58 is. And that's where it's at. Well, in actuality, there's more instruction in the New Testament about how to keep the Sabbath than in the Old. There's more instruction in the New than the Old. And it is interesting that, mainstream Christianity wants to live by the New Testament, and yet the New Testament reinforces the Sabbath more than the Old. So it is interesting as you think of that. So let's go over to Isaiah chapter 42 And we're going to spend most of our time in the New Testament, but we are going to look at Isaiah 42. Because it gives us a principle that we need to understand as we look at Christ and the Sabbath. How did Christ keep it? What did he do on the Sabbath? And this explains one of Christ's purposes. Isaiah chapter 42 and verse 21. So in chapter 42, we find a principle that is important to our understanding of the Sabbath. And it gives us some indication of how Christ acted. In Isaiah 42:21, it says, "The Lord is well pleased for his righteousness' sake. He will exalt the law and make it honorable." Another way of expressing the word exalt is magnify the law. Christ came in the flesh to magnify the law. He came to exalt the law, not do away with it. So he came to magnify it. And this is a most important scripture for understanding Christ's ministry. And a major part of the purpose of his ministry was to magnify the law. As you look at the Sermon on the Mount, Christ was magnifying the law there. He's magnifying the law. And it is there that Christ magnified that law that says you are not to hate your brother. In Old Testament times, it was don't murder your brother, so you could hate him all you wanted. That's not what God intended. But they basically came to the conclusion, well, as long as I don't kill him, I can hate him. And Christ said, sorry, that's not the standard. The standard is you can't hate him at all. Because hate leads to carrying out murder. And you may not murder him in fact, but you can murder him with words. You can murder him in various other ways. So Christ magnified the sixth commandment. And he said, you shall not murder. He also magnified the seventh commandment, saying, for you to even look on a woman with lust in your heart, or to look on a man with lust in your heart, that is the violation of the seventh commandment. So he expounded this and expanded their understanding of it. He magnified the law. Now we're not going to, so we see that this is what Christ did, and with the Sabbath, Christ did the same thing. Christ came to magnify the law, and he magnified the understanding of the Sabbath. We're not going to see that Jesus deliberately and frequently focuses attention on the Sabbath, not in the Sermon on the Mount, because there's not a, you know, he couldn't do it in that context, but Jesus did things right and he kept the Sabbath, and he gives us one example after another to help us to see what it's pointing to. So it is to Christ that we look for Sabbath principles. He's the one who set the perfect example for us. So in order to use the Sabbath time properly, we have to understand its purpose. And the question is, what is the purpose of the Sabbath? As you're here today, what is the purpose for the Sabbath? And I hope as we go through this, you'll be able to see what Christ did. We'll see his example and how he spoke about the day. And then it will help to enlighten us as to the reason we keep the Sabbath. So let's go to Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4, which tells us about the Sabbath day and Christ's observance of it. So in Luke chapter 4, Christ is beginning his ministry. Luke chapter 4, verse 16. In verse 16 it says, "So he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up." So he's speaking in his hometown to a hometown crowd. "And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read." So Christ, from a little child, had gone to the synagogue for the Sabbath. He was known there. And he did this regularly. It says, as his custom was. And he stood up to read on the Sabbath day. And in verse 17, it says, "And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah." This was the reading for that particular day. "And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written. And he said in verse, and it says in verse 18, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." So Christ began his ministry by quoting Isaiah, chapter 61, verse 2, and Isaiah 58, verse 7. And why did he begin there? What was his purpose? What was his point? Why did he choose that particular point to begin his ministry? And as you look at this, when did Christ begin his ministry? He began it on the Sabbath day, a most appropriate time for him to begin his ministry. And it is to be noted that Christ's ministry ended on a preparation day for the Sabbath, the Passover. His ministry came to a close on the Passover. So he completed the cycle. His ministry ended on the Passover, a preparation day. And as it went on, he was resurrected on the Sabbath. And major things happened to Christ on the Sabbath. We also find that major changes, major things occurred in the history of Israel on the Sabbath day as well. Maybe you've thought about this, maybe not. It talks about in this passage that we've looked at, which talks about the acceptable year of the Lord. What does that mean? That is a significant statement that Christ is making. And it's not a time when God becomes acceptable to us, but it's a time when God in his sovereign mercy is extending that mercy to make men acceptable to him, to open the way for men to be forgiven of their sins and to become acceptable to him. That's what the acceptable year of the Lord is all about. In other words, it's an extension of grace, of his calling men to make them acceptable, to, in essence, deliver God's people. More specifically, an acceptable year is referring to two Old Testament institutions. Two Old Testament institutions, which these people would have clearly recognized. Now, for us, we don't live in the Old Testament context, so we may not think of what he's talking about. And it's there are two occasions in Israel, ancient Israel, that could apply here. One is the seventh year land Sabbath. The land Sabbath, or the second occasion could be the Jubilee year, the 50th year. If it was the sabbatical year, think about the purpose of the sabbatical year. It was to give the land a rest. It was to give the land a rest. That is, to relieve it of the responsibility of growing food. To relieve it of that responsibility. And the land was to lie fallow. And the only people that were to have access to it were the poor, the dispossessed, and the animals. But you were not supposed to be out there in your field working like you regularly did. The land was to lie fallow. And whatever grew of its own was for those who were in need. An additional thing occurred in the Jubilee year, and that is the restoration of property to the original owners. So people, for varying reasons, it could be their own fault, it could be circumstances, but they've lost the possession that was given to them. The land that had been allotted to them, they've lost it. And as you think about land, it's most important. And because of indebtedness, they've lost it, and they lose the ability to produce on the land, which gives them an income. So they've gotten into a very serious circumstance, and many times people could not buy themselves out of it. But God said, "You don't have to, because when the Jubilee year comes, then the land returns to its owners." It returns to those to whom it was originally given. And as you think about the land is where wealth comes from. Wealth comes from the land. And it was given back to the original owners so they could put it into use and they could earn a living for themselves once again. So as you look at this, there was a release that took place there. The land returns to them. You look at the land Sabbath, it's a time of rest. So here we can begin to see in Christ's inaugural address that he's stating his mission. In case it involves, and in each case that you look at it, it involves liberty. Setting at liberty. Look again at Luke 4, verse 18. It says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor." He's coming to preach the gospel to the poor, and he's not talking about wealth. He's talking to people who are spiritually poor. People that are separated from God and don't understand God's way of life and what a benefit it is. They don't know that. And because they don't know the spiritual truths, they are weak and they're powerless. And if we look at this in the spiritual sense, it applies to each and every one of us because every one of us at one time was spiritually weak. We didn't know God's truth. We didn't know God. We didn't know his plan. We didn't know anything about that. And God brought us to the knowledge of that. It helps us to begin to see that we've all been spiritually powerless and weak. It goes on to say here that going on past verse 18, it says, "He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted." To heal the brokenhearted. And as you think about, that's what Christ came for, to heal the brokenhearted, to have freedom from discouragement. God sets us free from that. To proclaim liberty, to set them free, to give them deliverance. He's speaking to the captives, meaning to break the bondage of Satan and the world and the flesh. To set them free, to free the captives. And the recovery of sight to the blind. People don't see, but God opens their eyes to see. And to help to understand the great purpose for which we've been created. To set at liberty those who are oppressed, those who are downtrodden, to proclaim or preach the acceptable year of the Lord. And this is where Christ began. He said, "I am coming to set you at liberty. I am coming to free you from prison. I'm coming to enlighten your eyes so that you can begin to see." In verse 21, it says, "And he began to say to them, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." I am the Christ, and I've come to lay this all out for you and to show you what God's purpose is for me and why I'm here to be of service to you. As you go back to the book of Genesis, looking at a couple of verses there, it says in Genesis chapter 2, verse 3, "Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it." He blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. And God did not do that for any other day. The Sabbath is the day that he blessed. And a blessing is clearly shown in the Bible to something that is given or conferred in order to give somebody a better life. When you give a present to someone, why do you give it to them? You give it to them because you feel they will be benefited by it, whatever it is that you choose to give them. The blessing may be monetary. You know, we all like those greenbacks, and the color is always right, and it always fits. The perfect gift. Or it may be something that is spiritual, such as forgiveness. Or illumination of the mind to the truth. To have our minds opened and to begin to see God's great plan and our purpose in it. That's an unbelievable blessing. So we have those blessings that God has given to us. And the Sabbath is a blessing. A blessing given to us. And as we begin to see what the Sabbath represents, we understand what a blessing it is. What a blessing it is. And Christ's purpose and what he was telling them is, I've come to announce you're being set free and the way to abundant and fuller life, I'm making available to you. So the Sabbath is a day of liberation, a day to announce our freedom and a reminder of our being freed and our being liberated and to be able to live beyond bondage. It says in Genesis chapter 1, verse 22, it says, "And God blessed them." God blessed them. And what is he blessing in Genesis chapter 1, verse 22? He's blessing what he just created, the living creatures, the animals. And then in verse 28, he blesses man. And in Genesis chapter 2, verse 3, we find the capstone of his blessings in the creation week. It expresses God's blessing on his whole creation. His blessing on all of creation. And by blessing a recurring period of time, God promises to be man's benefactor. All men. He wanted all men to be blessed. That's why he created the Sabbath and set it aside to be kept by all men. Now, it also includes the physical as well as spiritual. You know, as you keep the Sabbath, you do get to rest. You know, you work during the week, and most of us on Friday, we're tired, and it's nice to come home, and it's nice to rest, isn't it? And some of us sleep in, so it's nice to sleep in. And it's nice to have a leisurely day. And it's also nice to be able to come and enjoy fellowship with other people of like mind. And there are physical benefits to it. And as you take one day out a week, it is not only a blessing to come to church and have a relaxing day, it's also conducive to our health, mental and physical, because we get everything back in line and we can rejuvenate physically. So it's a blessing in that way. But the physical is not God's primary intention with the Sabbath. That's not his primary intention. His intention is primarily spiritual. And he's emphasizing on the Sabbath day that he began his ministry the concepts of blessing, of deliverance, of liberty, of redemption. That's what the Sabbath is about. That's what Christ's ministry was about. So, as you go back to the origin of the Sabbath, back to Exodus chapter 20, and I'll just cite a couple of verses. We're not going to go back there. But in Exodus 20, where the commandments are stated, there are a couple of points that are important to note. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 2, it says, "I am the Lord your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." He begins in this verse laying out who he was. He had freed them from bondage, and then he lays out his law. And why did he lay out his law? The Ten Commandments, he gave them the law because he didn't want them to go back into bondage. And it's interesting in Exodus chapter 20, verse 11. He says, "And for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it," made it holy. So we've been taken out of the house of bondage, and as we can see here, the Sabbath is enjoined on God's people for two basic reasons. The first is to remind us that he is our creator and to remind us that we were once slaves. We were in bondage. And it's only as God set us free by opening our minds to his truth and his plan and his way of life did we become truly free. And it's free in the truest sense, in that it's spiritual. Remember back to Ezekiel 20, as a point of remembrance, that God talked about the Sabbaths and to keep the days holy. And when God's people don't keep the Sabbath, what happens to them? What happens to people that say, "You know what? I don't have to keep the Sabbath. In fact, I'm not going to anymore." What happens to you? You go back to where you came from. It is inevitable when you abandon the Sabbaths, then you will go back to where you came from. For Israel, where did they want to go? They wanted to go back to Egypt. And humanly, we go back there as well. So as we abandon the Sabbath, then we will give in to carnal nature, and it won't be long until we're right back where we started from. So the Sabbath is crucial to keeping us on track and reminding us where we came from, and we don't want to go back there. So God has specifically used the Sabbath throughout Israel's history as the day in which he emphasizes this. And that is to tie it into deliverance and liberty and keeping his people free. You see, as God brought Israel out of Egypt, he wanted them to remain free. And that's why he gave them the Sabbath as a weekly reminder of God's purpose and plan. And as they rejected that, then the inevitable consequence was to go back to Egypt. As you think about the Sabbath, it was on a Sabbath that Israel was freed from Israel, or Egypt, excuse me. And that was on the first day of unleavened bread. When did they reach the point where they were completely free from their slave owners? It was when they crossed the Red Sea on the seventh day of unleavened bread. On which day did God give his law? Wasn't it on a Sabbath, the day of Pentecost? On which day did Israel go into the land? In actuality, it was a Sabbath. When did they conquer the city of Jericho? Wasn't it on a Sabbath? The last day of unleavened bread. So we can see that historically, the Sabbath has been a big deal. Great events occurred on that day. And many of those events are about God freeing them, opening the door for them to wonderful things ahead, and giving them the blessings that he wanted to pour out on them. And Jesus emphasized liberty and freedom as he began his ministry. So we are told in the scriptures that we are to keep the Sabbath holy as the Lord your God commanded you. And it's a basic premise by which we live. So the Sabbath is clearly stated in Exodus chapter 20, and God wants us to remember that he is our creator. But that's not all of it. God wants us to remember that we've been released from bondage. Now, let's define a word that's important as we move forward here, and that's the word redemption. And it's important to our being able to understand the Sabbath. We have several words that are translated redemption in the scriptures, and we're not going to go through all these words. We're just going to kind of summarize the meaning of redemption. Of the two words that are most frequently used, the one has the sense of buying something back that has voluntarily been given up. Now, one way that you might understand this is by a pawn shop. If you're short on cash, then you can take something that you own and take it to the pawn shop and say, I want to redeem this for money. And he'll say, you know, I'll give you a small amount of money for that, and you know it's worth a lot more, but okay, I'll take the money. Maybe you negotiate with him and get a better price. But you've had to voluntarily give up the item that you own in order to get the cash that you need for whatever purpose it may be. And what do? Usually, if you give it up at the pawn shop, you want to try to eventually go and buy that back, that is, to redeem it. So this was valuable to me, and I want it back, so I'm going to go to the pawn shop and ask, pay and get my item back. So it's something that's voluntarily done where you redeem something that you've given up. The other one has the sense of paying a ransom price, of purchasing something or meeting a payment price for something that has been forcibly taken away. For instance, your TV disappears from your house. All right, so where could that TV have gone? So you go back down to the same pawn shop and you find, well, you know what? That looks like my TV. It's been forcibly taken from you, but you like that 66-inch TV, so you're willing to buy it back. So you're ransoming it in a sense. So those are two basic meanings of redemption. One is voluntary, the other is in regard to something that's forcibly taken away. What is important for us to understand is that in the biblical sense, redemption is not a one-time occurrence. If you've been a Christian, have you been redeemed more than once? Or is it just one time? Good question. And the answer is, we in our Christian lives have had to go through a whole series of redemptions or deliverances by God that do not end until our death comes or we're resurrected. So God, we go before God and we make mistakes, we sin, we fall short, and as we go to God and ask for His forgiveness, we're redeemed. We're redeemed once again. The blood of the Lamb is applied for us. The price is paid for us. And it doesn't happen once. It happens many different times. God delivers us. And Jesus, in His first address, is tying His work of being man's benefactor through redemption. I am your Redeemer. He's freeing us from Satan, the world, and our own human nature. And the beginning of the fulfillment of God's redemptive function begins on the Sabbath. We see this in Luke 4:16. So, this was at the beginning of Christ's mission, and then He begins to work with humanity and to go forward in preaching the gospel. And as you look at what takes place here, it's interesting. You see the redemption taking place, and He speaks about all of this, and then what immediately follows. Let's go back to Luke 4, if you're still there. Let's look in verse 31. So Christ has announced His mission, His purpose, and what He's going to do. So what happens right after He tells them about His mission and His purpose? Let's go to Luke chapter 4, verse 31. It says, "Then He went down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and was teaching them on the Sabbaths." So He was there. And He was teaching them on the Sabbath. This was what He had been doing, and He continued doing it. And so He's instructing the people at the synagogue in Capernaum on this day. So He came down there. It's a city in Galilee. And He was teaching them on the Sabbath. And they were astonished at His teaching, for His word was with authority. He didn't doubt what He was saying. He didn't hem and haw around. He laid it out for them quite specifically. And He continued this pattern throughout His ministry. So let's go down to verse 31 and go on beyond verse 31. It says in verse 33, it says, "Now in the synagogue there was a man who had a spirit of an unclean demon. And he cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'Let us alone. What have we to do with You, Jesus of Nazareth? Did You come to destroy us? I know who You are, the Holy One of God.'" So here are all these people sitting in the synagogue, and this individual that was in attendance there, he knew, or the demon knew, exactly who was speaking to them. This is the Son of God. And he starts shouting it out and disrupting the service. So this man is disrupting things. So what does Christ do? Verse 35, it says, "But Jesus rebuked him, saying, 'Be quiet and come out of him.' And when the demon had thrown him in their midst, it came out of him and did not hurt him." So he's dealing with a demonic being here, probably a demon with some power, and he really didn't want to come out. Why are you interfering with what we're doing? But Christ was in charge, and He commanded him to come out. And the demon did come out, and the man was free of the demon. But did Christ, this is a Sabbath, did Christ do this just for the fun of it? Or was there a purpose that He's telling us of here? He's telling us that His purpose is to give freedom and liberty to people. And how many people are influenced by Satan? It says the whole world has been deceived. And, you know, we can't really see, we can't really tell how many people are demonically influenced, how many people are possessed. We don't see it necessarily manifested, but they're out there. And it is something that we have to, that has to be dealt with, and Christ came to deal with it. So he cast the demon out. It says in verse 36, then they were all amazed and spoke among themselves, saying, what a word this is, for with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits and they come out. So he's declaring that my purpose as your Savior, as the one that is going to be King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and the work that I'm doing now is to free you from bondage. And part of the work that I am going to do is to take on Satan and the demonic world. And so he begins by casting out a demon. And then as you go down to verse 38, it talks about they went to Simon's house, and Simon's mother-in-law was sick. She had an infirmity. So what did he do? She was sick with a high fever, in verse 38, and they made request of him concerning her. So he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her, and immediately she arose and served them. So he begins with the healing of a man with a demonic spirit, and then he heals a woman who was sick with a very high fever. He intervened to heal her. Now, why does he begin doing this on the heels of his announcement of freeing mankind, setting them at liberty? He begins to take action. He talked, he said what I'm going to do, and he began doing it. Began doing it immediately thereafter. So what Jesus did here is a signal of his mission and his purpose. And he did it on the Sabbath day, which is symbolic of what the Sabbath reminds us of. Of freedom, of deliverance, of being set at liberty. So the first shot that we see fired in this war is on the Sabbath day. And it's important to recognize what Christ did on the Sabbath day is bring about healing and deliverance. So the second thing, so we see the physical healing here, and it's interesting what happened with Peter's mother-in-law. It says he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her, and immediately she arose and served them. Maybe that's an indication, you know, as God intervenes in our lives, that we should follow the example of being servants and applying our time to being of service to God. Although we're going to add quite a bit more there, in a nutshell, our major principles by which our Sabbath activities can be judged. The Sabbath is for redemption. It's for liberty. It's for joy. It's for peace and service that comes through fellowship and instruction and that reorients our devotion to the right direction. So we have to ask ourselves some questions in light of what we've seen so far. What do my activities have to do with my salvation? What is deliverance, which is redemption? Does what we are talking about and thinking about begin to fit within those parameters? As you think about the Sabbath and you think about your dealings with people on the Sabbath, is it redemptive in nature? Is it about setting people at liberty? Is that our approach? So we'll see some other examples here. Christ is giving us broad examples of what our approach should be. So let's go to Matthew chapter 12. So we see these two healings, Matthew chapter 12. And in Matthew chapter 12, we see another example of healing. And it is interesting that Christ chose to do these healings on the Sabbath day. Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 9. Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 9. It says, now when he had departed from there, he went into their synagogue. And behold, there was a man who had a withered hand. And they asked him, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, that they might accuse him? So these people were obviously aware of Christ healing. And so they said, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath, that they might accuse him? So these people are doing the provoking. Who's provoking whom? They're provoking him. They wanted him to heal this guy because then they could bring accusation against him, because in healing him, that was considered work. So is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And then verse 11, it says, "Then he said to them, 'What man is there among you who has one sheep, and if it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will not lay hold of it and lift it out?'" So if you were raising sheep and one of those sheep fell into a pit, would you leave it in there to die? No, you would take the time to drag it out of there, to somehow get it out of the pit. Now, you didn't push it into the pit on purpose. It fell in on its own. And then you go to save the animal from the ditch. It says, or how much more value then is a man than sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. That is a broad principle that Christ is laying out. It is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And he uses the analogy that every one of these people that are questioning him and accusing him, if their sheep fell in the ditch, they wouldn't think twice about saving the animal. And so you are asking me if it's lawful for me to heal this person who has a withered hand and has had that withered hand his whole life. You're asking me if that's acceptable? And they didn't get it. They didn't get it. So what did Christ do in verse 13? He said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and it was restored as whole as the other. Then the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might destroy him. This fellow has a withered hand, which limits him in what he can do day by day. And it's been a part of his life forever. It's a chronic part of his life. And yet Christ intervenes, and they're offended by it and upset about it, and they're plotting to kill him as a result. They didn't see Christ's purpose nor the purpose of the Sabbath. So we're going to go to Mark 3 now, which is another account of this particular incident. It adds something to it. It's the incident of the man with the withered hand. And let's go to chapter 3 and verse 1. Chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "And he entered the synagogue again, and a man was there who had a withered hand. So they watched him closely, whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to them, 'Man, who had the man to the man who had the withered hand, step forward.' And he said to them, 'Is it lawful to on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?' But they kept silent." They kept silent. Really, they knew the answer, but they didn't want to give the answer, the right answer, because they didn't want to be put on the spot, because they didn't want to support him in any way, shape, or form. Verse 5, "And when he had looked around at them and with anger," and he's angry with them because, what's wrong with you guys? You don't see the purpose for the Sabbath. You don't see the purpose for the coming of the Christ. And you think that you're so righteous, so spiritual, and here you are judging me for doing good. So he was angry, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts. Being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored as whole as the other. And again, the Pharisees then begin to consult with one another about how they can destroy them. As you look at this incident with the man with the withered hand, as you look in the context, think about the context in which this took place, there was at that time a circumstance that had been going on for a number of years in which the Jews were codifying the law. It had been going on for a while and was to go on for another couple of hundred years. The effort by which the Jews were compiling a code of regulations by which they hope to lay out that code so perfectly that nobody would sin. We'll set up all the rules and the guidelines and nobody will sin. Interestingly, there's a book called The Code of Jewish Laws, and it's a compilation of Jewish regulations. It's about 2 inches thick and one law after another. And they were very zealous in putting all of this together. But who can follow that? Do we have lengthy code books in our world? How many of you break laws? Not deliberately, but there are laws we break that we don't even know exist. But if somebody wanted to push it, they could. Well, you know, you broke this particular statute, and the fine for that is what? We don't know. But those things do exist. And as you look at the Sabbath, they eventually came up with 1,521 different regulations regarding the Sabbath. Now, how many regulations did God give? 10. One deals with the Sabbath in Exodus 20. The other one deals with the Sabbath in Deuteronomy 5. He gives some elaborations on it, but we don't have a whole book devoted to the Sabbath in the sense that there are all these rules and codes and things like that. Nobody can keep that. And that was the context of what we see here in this situation with the man with the withered hand. And as you look at the principle that's important to this, as you go and look at when Christ discussed the issue of divorce, where did he go? He's talking about divorce, and from their perspective, a man can put away a woman for any purpose. And where does he take them in discussing divorce? He said, let's go back to the beginning. And he takes them back to Genesis, and he says, man, woman, marriage, and you're to be married for life. He goes back to Genesis. So where do we go back to understand the Sabbath? God created it and established it, and we want to understand that that's what is the standard for all of us and all of mankind. And he's telling them, I'm not going to do away with it. And by the actions that he took on the Sabbath day, he wasn't doing away with it. He was showing them what the Sabbath is really all about, what is central to the Sabbath. So, as you think about this man, did Christ have to heal this man on the Sabbath? Think about it. He's had this withered hand for years and years and years. We don't know when. Was it from birth? We don't know. Or was he injured in some way? We don't know. So this was an ongoing problem. It wasn't something that began the day before. This is something that's been going on for probably most of this man's life. So Christ said, this man has a withered hand, and I'm going to heal him. Now, could Christ have said, we're not going to do this today, come back tomorrow? Could he have said that? He certainly could. But to emphasize the point that the Sabbath is a day for doing good, he healed the man. What he saw was this man needed to be healed. This man was suffering an affliction. And you're going to let it go? You would take the sheep out of the hole? And you're going to let this man continue on to suffer with this particular problem? So he made it whole, and by doing things in the order that he did, he was showing them that this is a day for doing good, a day of redemption, and something that we need to keep in mind as we keep the Sabbath. So, you know, as you and me, do we need the Sabbath? Do we have any chronic condition? We do. It's called sin. We all sin and we fall short of the glory of God. So do we need the Sabbath? Do we need God's intervention and God's mercy? Every last one of us does. And God is willing to intervene and to help us with sin and help us to overcome it. And he's giving us Sabbath as a part of that process. So we're here, brethren, on the Sabbath to prepare to be used for the salvation of others. Now, you may say, well, you know what? I don't think I'm going to be able to go out and do healings. I know I'm not. And we don't have that power at this point. But we do have the opportunity to do good. And it is perfectly acceptable to do good on the Sabbath day. So it's within our power to relieve somebody's burden. You know what we should do? We should do it. We can do things like we can write a letter of encouragement to somebody that we know is hurting. We can visit somebody that's not able to come to church or didn't come to church. We can do different things to help people. And we look at the congregation. That's why we assemble together to get to know each other. And as you know somebody is hurting or ill, we can pray for them. We can do things to help. And that's what we should be doing. That's following the example of Christ and rightly applying the principles that he's given to us. So we can encourage, we can make a call, we can be supportive. There are people hurting. I know at the feast, you know, just talking to people, you know, it's a joyous time, but one man has his wife die in the middle of the feast. And, you know, they've been married a long time. And her life comes to an end. So, you know, the people were there for him. And he decided, I'm driving back home. Got in his car, put his wife's purse on the seat, and headed home. People said, well, maybe you shouldn't go by yourself. And he said, I need to go by myself. And off he went. But those sad things afflict us even at the feast. Somebody's daughter had a baby. They've had 9 babies previously, and they're all healthy. This one is born Down syndrome, and it's not only has Down syndrome, but it's a floppy baby with lung problems. And last Thursday, they were going to operate on the baby to try to help the lung function. Who expects that? They had no idea that this was coming. But as you talk to these people that are facing that, you can tell that they're greatly affected. So people have things going on and difficulties and trials, and as we know each other, we know what's going on, and we can pray for one another. We can encourage one another. And am I standing up here saying, you know, I'm perfect in this? Because I'm not. But we could all improve in that, and that's what Christ's example is all about as far as the Sabbath is concerned. So as you look at Deuteronomy chapter 5, it says there that the Sabbath was made to show compassion toward the weak and defenseless. What does it say there? It says that you are to give others who are under your authority that day to rest. So if you have a manservant, a maidservant, and even your animals, you're to give them the day off. You're to give them the day off. And they don't have to carry any burdens that day. And Exodus chapter 23 speaks of the weakest people. It says that you would give your ox and your donkey rest, and also the son of your female servant and the stranger may be refreshed. The weakest people in society would be given the opportunity to be refreshed. So the New Testament shows that there are two types of Sabbath keepers. The epitome of a Sabbath keeper was Jesus Christ. And Christ's approach was always looking for a way to save life and to relieve burdens. And then there were the Pharisees who used the Sabbath time looking for faults, even going to the extent of thinking of methods of killing and accusing, which they did with the person who was the epitome of Sabbath keeping. So we need to be concerned for people's potential. That honors God, redemption, the new creation, love of neighbor, that is the essence of the Sabbath. So, believe it or not, there's more to the Sabbath, and next week we will continue this subject. There's some other things that we can learn as we think about this particular subject, and it is good to think about it. So we might all think about, as I look at Christ's example, am I living up to it? And that's a very high bar that we can all strive for, and hopefully we will. So hopefully you found this profitable, and thank you for your attention.